Blog Talk Radio.
This is Our Common Ground. Tonight, on an Our Common Ground special, attacks starting in Wisconsin on collective bargaining rights, labor rights, equal rights, human rights. Here in America, the working poor and the poor are under attack. Stay tuned.
Good evening. Thank you for being here with us at Our Common Ground. This is our special programming in regard to the attack on labor, working people, and the poor. With me tonight is my co-host, Alpho, and we thank you so much for being here. Alpho, good evening, and thank you for being here with us as well on Our Common Ground.
Good evening, Janice, and how are you this evening?
Okay, you had an interesting conversation going on over on TruthWorks with Dr. Deborah in regard to the status and the intersection of race and labor, and I found the conversation intriguing, and I want to thank Dr. Deborah at A Heart for My People with Dr. D for that conversation. Tonight we've got a lot of work to do. What we're going to try to do is get to the question of what are the consequences, what does this attack on working poor and poor people, who's behind the attack, what's the history behind what's going on in this country in regard to the attack, and we'll take your calls at 347-838-9852 as we frame this issue.
We have this opportunity to stand here with you and say these things that need to be said, things that I want to personally say. America is not broke. America is not broke. Is not broke.
don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Things have got to change.
How many stations does this go?
You've got to get mad. You've got to say,
I know it was to Louisville and Atlanta.
And they're going to take this anymore. Then we'll figure out what to do about the depression and the inflation and the oil crisis. But first, get up out of your chair, open the window, stick your head out and yell, and say, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Who are you talking to, Ryan?
CGG,
are they yelling in Atlanta, sir?
Are they yelling in Atlanta, Ted?
But first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.
God damn it. Get up, get up, get up out of your
chair. Son of a bitch! We struck the mother load.
Stick your head out of the window, open it, and stick your head out and keep yelling and yell, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore. Just get up from your chairs right now. Go to
where
the
window. Where are you going?
Everybody,
I don't want to
see
anybody
yelling. Everybody, just go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell and keep yelling. I'm
mad as hell. I'm not going to take this anymore.
I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore. I'm mad as hell.
You're tuned in to Our Common Ground, our special on the attack on working people and poor people in America. Yes, we should be mad as hell. Our basic tenets of justice, democracy, liberty, and human rights have been stolen and sold in this country. Stay tuned.
Alpha, you know, my basic question tonight, and you're going to take the lead on this show, is how in the world do we get people to understand that they ought to be sticking their heads out of the windows all over this country yelling, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore?
Are you kidding? Do you really think that in this day and age that people are going to interrupt their Housewives of Atlanta or NBA Housewives or they're going to somehow interrupt their America Can Dance or American Idol or We've Got Talent or Pookie and Ray Ray. Please, they have used that idiot box. I call it the idiot box, and I watch a great deal of it. I'm a sports fanatic, and as a matter of fact, I'm missing a game or two now. But since my television is on the blink, and I think it's outrageous.
DVR that sucker.
Yeah, the DVR was hooked up to the TV they took, okay? But, I mean, really. You know, we get the electorate has become complacent. They've become too dumbed down to realize that if you don't take this bull by the horns, you know, the people that I advocate for, the people that I want to get tough are simply not going to do it. They are paid prostitutes like the Republicans are. They are the Democrats. But they are weak. They are weak paid prostitutes. You know, with all of the low-hanging fruit out there, you don't see this initiative coming from Democrats. Nancy Pelosi sent me an email asking for $5, and the email was subject, enough is enough. Oh, it's not enough. It was enough when you pulled impeachment off the table. You know, fighting. You know what? It. You know, I always talk about the lesser of two evils, because leave us face it. Who's gonna win as president as an independent? Just pray them out there. Don't tell me
about
what could be if we wake up.
Wait, okay. Let's go through this again. One more time, okay? Because I don't believe that you are saying to me that the thousands of people who woke up in Wisconsin, the thousands of people who woke up in Ohio, are they not going to be the same people? Hold on. Let's start this again.
We have this opportunity to stand here with you and say these things that need to be said, things that I want to personally say. America is not broke. America is not broke. Is not broke.
People wanna know.
People wanna know
who we are.
Who we are.
Oh, we tell them.
Oh, we tell them.
We are the union.
We are the union.
America is not broke.
Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
So, Alfo, you're telling me that everybody didn't get up out of their chairs. When Michael Moore said America is not broke, they still weren't convinced they ought to be mad as hell?
Let me put it like this. What we've seen in Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio were people who are being hurt in the aftermath of lethargic, idiotic, dog whistle of racism that led them to vote for Republicans because they dislike this black man in the White House. They're up in arms because their pockets are being hurt. They are against this because it's their pockets that are being hurt. I come to you from this position. Why is it that it took the loss of 14, 16 states north of the Mason-Dixon line to turn state houses and state senates and state governments to Republican and start the rise of states' rights? Now you have all of these people, and half of them that are out there voted for these people. And now they've shown, they were lied to, they were led astray, they were bamboozled. Call it what you want.
Well,
what
let's
we have
hear
who simply
who
have
you're
voted
talking about.
Against their best interest.
Okay, Michael Moore and Rachel Maddow, of all the voices in America, seem to have had for a very long time all of the depth of insight that was needed, especially by white people, to understand what was going on. Let's hear what Michael Moore and Rachel Maddow had to say about what has happened in those states that you just mentioned.
And you never hear the word occupation, which is exactly what it is. And I'm trying to think of when in my lifetime I've seen a state capitol building occupied by the people for now. What day is this? We're going into...
They were in day 15 when
day
I left.
Day 15 of occupying a state capitol. I think that the old Soviet, whoever used to run the Soviet TV station, if he's still alive, he must think, wow, these guys are geniuses at NBC and ABC and CBS, because they have kept the American people in the dark about this explosion, this essentially revolution that has started in Madison but is now spreading across the country.
There's no question. I mean, let's not forget, in addition to the occupation of the State House by the people of Wisconsin, you also have 14 Democratic state senators who've been out of state for
right.
14 days or
right.
more.
Right.
One of them is in his 80s.
Right.
You've got protests all across the state and in Indiana, where the Democrats have also left
yeah.
there. We went to Ohio. It's
mm-hmm.
spreading there.
Yeah, it's going
and
to
over
Michigan.
This weekend, there were protests in all 50 states.
Yeah. Yeah, everywhere.
What do you think's happened?
I think people have had it. I think that that this is a movement that is not going to stop. This is not just a protest or two, or let's all get in the bus and go to Washington, D.C. for a Saturday afternoon. People are pissed off. I mean, they are really upset. They're angry. They're disappointed that the Democrats and the president have not been at the forefront of this, you know, leading the charge.
But then something like this comes along, and we're all reminded that if it were all about the budget, people hired by the state would not be getting $12,000 raises, whether or not they were state senators' girlfriends. And you see this writ large in the policy Republicans are pursuing. Not everybody is taking a hit financially in these states that are pleading poverty. And this is important. These Republican governors and Republican legislatures all over the country keep saying that they're broke. They keep saying it's about the budget, it's about the budget, it's about the budget. But they are being incredibly generous to some with their budgets. Whether it's state senators' girlfriends or the forces in our society to whom they would like to redirect what are now public assets, there are some people who are making out like bandits toward whom states pleading poverty are being incredibly generously profligate. In Maine, for example, the Republican governor there wants to spend $30 million giving a tax cut to about 550 individuals, 550 of the state's millionaires. In Ohio, House Republicans say they want to spend $10 million to give the petroleum industry in their state a tax break. Pennsylvania's Republican governor wants to spend big on business as well. His tax proposals have been estimated to cost the state between $200 and $833 million. Remember, he's pleading poverty. New Jersey's Republican Governor Chris Christie wants to spend $200 million on tax cuts to business. Remember, we're broke. Not to be outdone, Florida's Republican governor wants to spend $1.5 billion on tax cuts for corporations. Michigan's Republican governor wants to spend $1.8 billion on business tax cuts. And of course, in Wisconsin, Republican Governor Scott Walker, his giveaways to business, his first actions as governor, are projected to cost the great state of Wisconsin nearly $140 million. And remember, we're broke. This is some spectacular generosity towards some very specific parts of society among these governments that are pleading poverty, complaining about giant state budget deficits. And states do have budget deficits. But all of these giveaways I just described are things that will make those deficits worse. All the Beltway media reporting on the fight in the states is about how governors are making hard choices and taking controversial steps to close their budget deficits. But all of these things they are doing open budget deficits wider. They make the budget problems in all these states worse, and they bend over backwards to do it. The people who are not benefiting from Republican generosity in the states, they're the ones facing cuts. In Georgia, the legislature looking at cutting funding to the state's university system by about $75 million. Pennsylvania's Republican governor proposing a more than 50% cut to that state's higher education system. In New Jersey and South Carolina, Republican governors want to drastically cut Medicaid benefits. In Arizona, the Republican governor's budget would get rid of health care for 100,000 poor people. Just in case anybody even tries to make a case that this is all ideological, this is just about Republican opposition to taxes and opposition to spending, consider that in most of these states, not only are Republican governors or legislatures trying to cut things like education and social services, they are also overtly raising taxes on poor people. We've got tax hikes on the elderly and on low-income residents in Michigan. Also, Republicans in Kansas and in Wisconsin are talking about effectively raising taxes on the working poor. In Georgia, House Republicans are talking about raising taxes on groceries. Also, they're talking about ending a tax break for blind people. That's up for grabs in Georgia right now. Raising taxes on the blind. And just to spread the pain around, in Maine, the Republican governor's proposed budget would raise property taxes for the middle class. This is not some sort of policy doublespeak, right? This is Republicans proposing tax increases. I keep hearing that what Republicans are doing in the states is about closing the budget gaps. When you give away hundreds of millions of dollars to businesses, when you give those away as state revenues, that makes your budget problem worse, not better. And every time the national media reports these states that are giving these huge tax giveaways to businesses as closing the budget gap, they are wrong. Every time we hear that this is an ideological opposition to taxes among these Republican governors and legislatures, you got to ask, what you believe about tax cuts, tax increases for poor people. Are tax increases for poor people also tax hikes? Huge tax cuts for the people in this country who are already wealthy, and tax increases on the poor and the unemployed and elderly people. The next time somebody tells you Republicans are anti-tax, ask them to be specific. We've been covering this story for a while now. I have a feeling we will continue to cover it for a long time. But whether it is the state senator's girlfriend and her giant raise, or it's multi-million-dollar profligate giveaways to people who already have the most money in these states, again, let it be known, it is not about the budget.
I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime. You've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
There you are, Alpha.
There I am.
Yep. Here we are. Dr. D has mentioned in the chat room that we are going to be two classes of folks in this country, the haves and the have-nots. I think we're already there.
Well, you know, when you begin to deal with aggressive people, and those are the Republicans, and the passive people, those are the Democrats, who simply sit back and allow this to take place. When you point out that it's the corporations and their surrogates, which are the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Republicans, all they have to do, once you point that out, is begin to whine that you are engaging in class warfare, and Democrats will back off. When the bottom line is simply this, as Rachel Maddow pointed out in that clip, they're giving money to the rich and screaming poverty while they balance or try to balance and cut spending on the backs of the poor. And until there is a messaging situation coming from the Democrats, it's an uphill fight. It's a steep uphill fight. Because all of these people who voted for these Republicans voted for them because they have gotten that dog whistle messaging. They were won over by repetitive lies that basically suck them in to the fear of this black president and the fear that he's a socialist. He's going to take your gun. He's a Nazi. You know, he's not like us. And over and over and over, I don't give a damn what you think about the faults of this president. The faults of this Democratic Party are greater. Oh, he didn't close Guantanamo like he said. He told them to close Guantanamo. The Democrats voted against it. Notwithstanding every Republican, they were joined by Democrats. They voted against it. And what did the Republicans do? They come before a microphone and a camera and scream about the threat, the danger of trying people in the cities, and they'll just become targets. And they say it over and over and over again, and they back down. And that is my problem. You've got too many Democrats who simply back down. You see, the president is coming home early from his trip. Why? Because he was getting criticism. He's afraid of these people. Democrats are afraid of these people. These people own the media. They conduct the message. Look at how the plight of the middle class and the working poor and the public workers have fallen off the radar, and they have fallen to the rise of the earthquake. It's not this earthquake isn't big news. It is. It's not that Libya is not big news. It is. But the rights of collective bargaining, the pain that's being not shared, there's no shared sacrifice, but there's no army of surrogates to go out here and vilify. You know, you're into a system where they're screaming for civility. Progressives and liberals are willing to be civil. But the Republicans are business as usual. So what do you have? You have a lack of messaging. Now all the Republicans are chiding the very same line as Muammar Gaddafi. And they're talking about Obama is for Al-Qaeda. He's helping Al-Qaeda with this airstrike. They were all talking about how he didn't act soon enough. Why isn't he doing anything? What is he doing? Then when he does something, they come out with an army of surrogates and they criticize him. They shape and frame the narrative. They take over the perception. And that's what the American people fall victim to.
There are two responses that I have to all of this, especially the discourse that's going on from the neocons today and yesterday. One is that in this country we have a class war going. We have always had a race war. It has been blended with a class war. So we have a race and class war going. And the first casualty of war is truth. The other problem that I have, Alpha, is that as a black nationalist, and sometimes black pan-Africanist, is that electoral politics are not our only option. But in order to get to where our power is, we have to think through these issues on a different dimension than they are thinking about it. Black people's history and culture require that we do so. But in the din, in the confusion, and in the silence, where is the black voice in all of this? When you talk about poor people in this country, you're talking about black people in this country. When you talk about the working poor, you're talking about black people in this country. And there is no voice about what that means and what are some of the solutions. So I think that one of the things that we have to think is that electoral politics, one, is one of the answers, but two, not all of the answers. Let's take a look at what Noam Chomsky had to say about elections in this country, because we're talking about politicians. And to me, Republicans, Democrats, Tweedledee and Tweedledum.
Campaign funding is a remarkably good predictor of election and also of policy. You can pretty well predict policies by looking at where the campaign funding comes from. There's good political science work on this. Thomas Ferguson, a very fine political economist, has done extremely good work on this, and it's convincing. And in fact, we see it right in front of us all the time. So the rate of election of incumbents is overwhelming. It's like 98-99%. This is happening at the same time that public attitudes towards approval of Congress is in the low teens, but they're outspending their opponents. That's okay, they get elected, even if people don't like them. Or just take the last election, 2008. I mean, the core of Obama's funding was financial institutions. They preferred him to McCain. They thought he'd serve them better, and it's turning out it's probably true. You can almost read off the policies of the administration from looking at the concentrated campaign funding. Financial institutions are doing marvelously. So, yes, taking money out of politics would be a good idea, very good. It's not going to solve all our problems. They're much deeper than that. But it would be substantial. It would be hard because there are all kind of ways to get around it. But it's an important topic, and here tendencies are going in the wrong direction. Right now, the Supreme Court is considering a suit which, you know, what it amounts to is if they change the law, which they probably will, it means that corporations can buy elections directly instead of indirectly. So that they don't put it that way, but you think through it, that's what it amounts to. So that's what the Supreme Court is doing. And there's something kind of surreal going on, because at the very same time, the logic of this for the Supreme Court is that corporations are persons. They have personal rights, so therefore have the right of free speech. That was, in fact, a gift to the corporate world by the courts about a century ago. Conservatives who used to exist, the name does, not the category, bitterly condemned it. They called it a form of communism, a return to feudalism, and so on. But they got it, and by now they have rights way beyond persons. So because they have rights of persons, they have the right of free speech, so therefore they can buy elections directly. At the same time, Congress is, there's a competition going on in Congress between the Democrats and the Republicans to see who can be more brutal in denying health care to undocumented aliens. And there's a legal argument behind that, too. They're not persons under the law. The courts have shaped American law so that if you're an undocumented alien, you're not a person. You don't have personal rights. So on the one hand, corporate entities have rights of persons and have to be allowed to buy elections directly. On the other hand, undocumented aliens on whose backs a lot of the economy rides, they're not persons, and therefore we, the Democrats and the Republicans, have to show that we're more savage than the opposition in denying them health care. We shouldn't be allowing this to happen before our eyes. I mean, the facts are there, but they're not being discussed. They're not being addressed. And that's another serious lack of people who care about living in a civilized community.
What they do, they shout it in your face. And so, Alpha, we have Democrats and Republicans. A White House that's smiling in our face and all the time they're stabbing us in the back because they are really not interested in a civilized society, a society that allows and offers human rights to every individual.
Well, Janice, let me say this. We can sit and we can play nice. And unless from the progressive liberal side they are willing to exact a pound of flesh from these people, this has to be an all-out attack. This has to be an all-out form of vilification. We lack surrogates. We lack a message. House Music Lover in our chat room asked how many black folks was on meet on the Sunday shows. What does it matter? How many were invited? They're not even being invited. Labor is not even being invited. But they'll have the Republican point of view on a daily basis. They're constantly in front of a camera.
Even when they are there.
They don't say
even when they are there, they don't speak to the interests of black people. And later on, we're going to be having a feature with Dr. Claude Anderson about how we need to remedy that. But even when they are there, I mean, if you think about who gets voice, you know, whether it's a comedian or a hip-hop star, or a rapper, even in our world, in our community, we can't point to but two handfuls of people. But we don't support them. I mean, how many people across this country in this audience support the United Black Front or the Malcolm X grassroots organization or the U.S. Human Rights Network or David D. Hip Hop, if you're into hip hop, or blackdoctors.org or Black Women's Blow Your Trumpet or... I mean, I can go on and on and on, and nobody is bringing it real. Nobody is bringing it real. For instance, if you think about our comedians, and you know, and I don't know a comedian, a Black comedian, that I'm particularly enamored with right now, and you compare that person to other stand-up comics like Bill Maher, or George Collin, and people forget that Michael Moore started off as a stand-up. We're in trouble, and we've got calls. You want to go to the phones?
Have at it.
313, you're on the air.
Hi, it's
I
me.
Me?
It's Dr. Deborah.
Oh, Dr. Deborah, come right on in and have at it, as Alpha says.
I won't hold you long. First, what I want to say is they're not going to invite someone on any of those shows who's going to speak their mind and speak the truth. The only people that they're going to put on are people like Harold Ford, who would stab his own mom in the back to attain his goals. People like Cynthia Tucker, who has a tinge of truth every now and then, but she's very docile, if you will, with her presentation. They're just not going to put those type of folks on, or they might put Tavis Smiley on if they really want someone who's going to dog Obama. And the reason that I'm not in love with him is because I feel like it's personal. Some of the feelings that he has, personal animosity towards Obama. So we are in trouble because we don't really have a medium to get that word out there. And the other thing is, I think that the reason that the Republicans have been so successful at what they've done, beside the fact that Democrats have stood there purposely, I don't think they're weak at all. They know exactly what they're doing. Is because if we make this argument or if they make this argument about poor, who sees themselves as poor? So if I can don't have to connect to that, then I can feel like, so what? They deserve it. They have a way of depicting poor folks as being lazy and shiftless and all of those negative connotations, the same way that they do about the illegal aliens, which is, you know, absolutely the furthest thing from the truth. They're not lazy. They work from sun up to sundown in unbearable conditions for nothing. And our government is complicit with the Mexican government in allowing this market. And that's the story that people don't talk about. They don't come over here to... Go ahead.
In relation to the issue of labor and the labor movement and the consequences that Black people will pay as a result of this attack, one of the things that I get very concerned with is, with the exception of my good friend George Wilson,
mm-hmm.
who airs now for 2 hours on Sirius Radio, and Masamela Mamfumo, few of them will have labor leaders on and
mm-hmm.
challenge the standing of Black people in the labor movement and their presence in the rank and file.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I mean, it's just...
And I like your point about people not people being ashamed that they are poor. If you can't make 4 car payments in 1 month and you can only make your car payment on a monthly basis, you are poor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if the car payment is $585 a month. That makes you dependent on a paycheck coming in. If you are dependent on a paycheck coming every 2 weeks or every week or every month, you
mm-hmm.
are part of the working poor.
Mm-hmm.
Or, and I mean, people love to talk about people getting welfare checks. They get theirs on a monthly basis or however, but they are poor and you are working poor. And there is not.
The other thing, Janice, on the flip side of that is, who gets the most welfare in this country? Corporations.
Absolutely.
Who pay basically nothing into the system. They drag on it and suck it dry, but they return nothing into it on the backs of the people that go out and do the work and actually make the profit happen. So when we talk about shiftless and lazy people, who we really should be focusing on is the people at the top of the pie chain as opposed to the people at the bottom of the pie chain, because the people at the top are not doing anything but devising ways to come up with more ways to suck money out of every way they can, and our government rolls right along with that. They allow these companies to have offshore accounts where they don't have to pay taxes into our system, you know, and the list is endless. So the welfare that exists in this country at the bottom pales in comparison to the welfare that exists at the top. And that's what we need to be talking about and saying and educating people, especially young people, because they just haven't even been around long enough to even understand that. I certainly can say when I was 25 or 30 years old, I didn't get it in the way that I do now. When you're young, you're out working, you're married or whatever, you're trying to raise your family, you're looking at people alongside of you, near you, in your neighborhood, who media is making you feel is pimping the system. They're on welfare. They're this, that, and other. When the reality of it is they're doing nothing to this system. As a matter of fact, they're helping those at the top keep people defocused off of who the real enemy is. So, you know, people don't understand all of that and need to really be educated. Where that education is going to come from other than a one-on-one, you know, every time we get a chance to talk to our family, friends, and just kind of educate and begin to make people at least start thinking about it. Because we're not going to hear that on television. We just aren't. We may find it in print, but you're going to have to look hard. You're not going to find that on a newsstand. You're going to have to really know some very progressive, mediums in print to really go out here and find this stuff that exists. You're not just going to get that in the way that they, you know, spread the lies through the general medium that we're used to getting. So I don't honestly, you know, pretend here to know all the answers. I'm stumped on some of this and where do we go. And I said in the show earlier tonight on my part of it, my part of the show, that, you know, we don't have a mobilizer. Right. We just don't. We're really kind of like fish out of water here now. We're flapping around. And the reality of it is we're sort of, in a way, in survival mode in a very unhealthy way, because we're so afraid of what's getting ready to happen that we're grasping on to things that when, in a good time, we would think twice about. We're listening to propaganda, and I, honest to goodness, when I say this, I mean this with no malice, but, you know, it's very unfortunate what happened over in Japan. But we got our own damn tsunami in the United States. It's been going on for years.
Let me say this, Deborah.
Yes, sir.
We have to come to a conclusion. You know, if I'm standing outside and I'm yelling at a business or at a corporation,
mm-hmm.
they're all inside and they're all on the 52nd floor. Is that going to resonate? No. If I pick up a damn brick and throw it through the damn window, somebody's going to pay attention. And mm-hmm. until we declare this a war, until we vilify these corporations, these bankers, this Chamber of Commerce, this Republican Party that is the tool.
And Democrats.
These puppet masters. Until someone from the other side does something so drastic. When they talk about, when you say they only bring in the people who are going to be nice in front of the cameras on these networks.
Mm-hmm.
Until we find an elected official who will call a news conference, get the press there, and then say something outrageous or call somebody a mofo. To that point where, you know, that's why I was an admirer of an Alan Grayson, because he got the attention. Anthony Weiner
mm-hmm.
the attention, because they are willing to say the truth in graphic,
mm-hmm.
as graphic as they possibly can, and that's what we are up against. With the lack of the sound machine, we can't simply speak in with civility. We have to speak with radical, hard language. And that's the bottom line.
But
if you're
Alpha,
telling the truth, there should be nothing that you should be afraid to say.
Okay, let me ask you this, though. Who is that person, and what do we do in the meantime while we mobilize them? Because I'm going to be honest with you. For the most part, I'm going to say in 98% of the case, I see absolutely no difference in the Republicans and the Democrats. I really, really don't. You know, I give the Republicans credit in that they're willing to stand up and take the hit for the lie. They're willing to tell a lie. They're willing to denigrate people. They don't care. The Democrats are no better. Because, you know, if you don't believe that, why are you standing there silently, not saying a word? Because, you know, I'm a believer, Alpha, that the truth will always win. It may not succeed today. It may not succeed tomorrow. But the truth will win. So if you combat a lie with the truth. People may not catch on to it first because, you know, we live in a society that sort of seems to sort of gravitate toward lies, and, you know, the more we embellish bullshit, the more people seem to really get drawn to it. But if you stand there and you constantly tell the truth, eventually I feel like it's going to sink through. But they're not doing that. So when I hear people say the Republicans, I have to laugh. Because what is the difference between a Republican and a Democrat other than one has a D in front of their name and one has an R? They both take money from the same coffers. They lie. One lies covertly. One lies, you know, overtly. What's the difference? I'm just asking, where is this person? And how do we mobilize behind them? And what do we do in the meantime until that happens?
Sometimes you can ask the wrong question, and we end up getting the wrong answer. I hear you saying, "Where is this person?"
Or persons.
I think that we have to say, "Where is this movement?"
Okay.
Where is the strategic program
mm-hmm.
for our people to get their heads screwed on properly so that they can intake the kind of information they need to process?
But Janice, don't you feel that with any movement, there are some central characters, if you will, movements don't, people just happen to have ESP and connect with each other one day and wake up and say, we're going for this goal and this is how we're going to get there. Don't you generally have
When you think about the civil rights movement, the civil rights movement started with 12 students sitting in a classroom talking over the issue of race with the professor and decided that they knew some place where they could take their voice to be heard.
Well, that's what I'm asking. Where are those 12 people, if you will?
That is why
I don't mean to be literal, but
yeah, that is why, you know, that is what we are in a whole different complexity. But that is why we have to keep looking at the premise that all politics, and this is about politics, it's about
absolutely
politics in our community. All politics are local. I've got to go to another caller.
Okay, have a good evening.
You've given us a lot. I hope this audience really listened to what you were saying, because it is a kind of truth that should prevail, and it only prevails, as Alpha says all the time, by repeating it over
and over again
and over. That's right.
Absolutely. Have a good one. I'm listening.
Thank you, Dr. D.
Thank you, Dr. D.
410, you're on the air. I respect you. Thank you for your call.
Hey, how you doing? I heard you guys say earlier that you were going to have a segment with Claude Anderson coming up, and I am a big fan of Dr. Anderson, so I'm definitely looking forward to that. And he's very relevant to this conversation, because the kind of truth that he brings in his lectures is the kind of truth you're not really seeing from any other form of black leadership we have out there, whether it's, you know, Rainbow Coalition, NAACP, or the Urban League. And, you know, he's very clear in setting forth who he thinks the enemy is and what he thinks the problem is. And when he comes forth to define who the enemy is, he doesn't equivocate in telling you he thinks it's white conservative America. And most black people, most black intellectuals, are very remiss to come flatly and to just make the bold statement that they have a clear and common enemy, and had a clear and common enemy since this country's founding. And it's very strange to hear blacks kind of equivocate and wiggle around in their seats. It's so uncomfortable to come forward and say this, particularly if you were to go and ask an Israeli who his enemy is. You could ask any Israeli on the street. 9 out of 10 are going to tell you, without equivocation, it's a Palestinian. You ask them how long they've been at war with the Palestinians, they'll tell you 40 years. You ask the average black person who their enemy is, they can't give you an answer. But you've been at war with white conservatives for over 200 years. All you have to do is read the history. They have been opposed to black Americans at every single turn of history in this country. They have never been aligned with us on anything. And today, they're still opposed to us. And the reason why black leadership is so feckless is because they're unwilling to make their admission, number one. And number two, they're unwilling to do the hard work that Dr. Claude Anderson has done, which is to find the laws, because as one professor used to tell me all the time, the empire is in the laws, to find the laws that disenfranchise and disadvantage black people in this country, and to attack those laws specifically and directly to get public policy changes, which is the reason the civil rights movement was so successful, was because they didn't focus on bigotry and prejudice. They focused on racism. And black people are still confused about which is the more important of the two to be concerned with. Bigotry and prejudice is when some white guy at the end of the bar calls you a nigger. That is of no concern to me. Racism is about governmental and institutional disenfranchisement of a people. That is the only thing of concern to me. We need not concern ourselves with trying to have other people like us. I don't give a damn about that. The only thing I care about is whether or not you are blocking my admission to a college, you are blocking a job, you are blocking me starting a new business, you are blocking me buying a home. Outside of any kind of institutional or governmental racism, We need not have black organizations focus on anything else. And right now, if you look at the NAACP, the Urban League, or the Rainbow Coalition, they're running around the country responding to racism. Somebody did something to this, somebody called somebody a nigger, somebody. Who cares? Ask them what legal structure they're trying to tear down that is currently disenfranchising blacks that they'd like to see removed so those blacks are no longer disenfranchised, and you will hear crickets. Because they aren't attacking the empire, and the empire is in the laws. Now, Dr. Claude Anderson runs an institution called the Harvard Institute. I myself happen to be a lawyer. I would love to work with Dr. Claude Anderson in attacking the empire itself, and I think if you had a number of blacks come together to focus on that and stop worrying about wanting to be liked, the South is the South. South has been the same. South has been the same for 200 years. South is not going to change. It is what it is. Okay.
Well, I am sure, caller, that Dr. Anderson would welcome someone working with him who has the skills and the capability to carry the Harvest Institute's work across this country, because. I know in the 80s, one of the reasons that he has not been successful in penetrating the barriers in communities across this country, in black communities across this country, has to do with this whole question of how we frame legitimacy. Do you understand what I'm saying? I hope everyone is understanding what I'm saying. If your face is not on NBC or ABC or CBS, or if someone hasn't said something, called your name from the White House, you have no legitimacy as a black instigator, expositor, leader, scholar, writer. And that is one of the things, the people who serve our interests, who speak our hearts and interests need. We need to get off the idea that somehow fame and leadership are, what do you call it, equivalent. They are not.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with you.
I mean, he's his book, what was it, Black Labor, White Wealth. I mean, it's been out for quite a few years now. It didn't get much discussion when it came out in the national media. And they largely ignore, you know, any similar book that's come out, they've ignored as well. I mean, it's just not in their interest to do so. But what I mean is you have people like, you know, the current black leadership you have right now is just not speaking in a clear voice and has no clear agenda. So when people are all, like, up in arms about Obama, and Obama hasn't given us what we want. What do you want? I could ask 10 black people walking down the street what the black agenda is. I get 10 different answers. When I ask a Hispanic person or a Jewish person what their agenda happens to be with their particular sex of people, I guarantee you 9 out of 10 is probably going to answer in a pretty clear voice what that happens to be. We have no agenda. So for us to yell up and down, well, Barack Obama's not serving our agenda. What agenda would that be? What exactly,
well,
specifically would we like to see him do that he hasn't done?
Part of the problem has to do with this whole confusion in our community that somehow, you know, it's the white folks stamp. That if you don't have the white folks stamp, you know, I mean, if you look at, I don't know if you were with us on the Hard for My People with Dr. Deborah show tonight. If you look at what has happened in the labor movement, one of the reasons that a black voice within unions have not addressed the issue of Title VII, the issue of Executive Order 11246, the issue of lobbying going on within unions, the issue of banks and financial institutions and the responsibility to the Community Reconstitution Act is because we have this issue and question about legitimacy. Who is the legitimate? And I hope some all of you will join Dr. Deborah next week, because her topic is going to be called the Uncle Tom Syndrome, dealing with the issue of leadership in the Black community. But, you know,
it definitely is a problem when you have a lot of people, same thing with, you know, Farrakhan, anybody else who kind of speaks out, and a kind of, you know, uncompromising voice gets labeled as a radical. And, you know, most Black people tend to just run away from them.
If you look at Michael Moore, he's too fat, he's too frump. If you look at Rachel Maddow, she's much, much too much dyke. If you look at people like the brother minister Louis Farrakhan, he's so much of he's too Black.
Well, isn't that the same as arguing ad hominem? Because they can't directly attack the message, so they attack the person instead.
Absolutely.
And that's
absolutely
what we fall victim
absolutely
to. Too many times
absolutely
we fall victim to. Louis Farrakhan is too militant. Jesse Jackson is not relevant. You know, Dr. Claude Anderson's his works, his books have been profound to the utmost, but yet you never see him in front of a camera, a microphone, anywhere. And I look at it. One thing I heard him say in one of his speeches is that the wealthy Black athletes, the wealthy entertainers, won't give him a dime. And he's already told them it's all tax deductible. But his think tank, they will not fund it, because they want to scrutinize him, whereas they will give their money, you know, in other places that are not looking to achieve the things that he's looking for. Didn't they ask and pay him to consult them in Detroit? And after he did his work, they rejected it, and then look at where Detroit went from there.
That's right.
It's amazing.
And then we had all of this government funds going to faith-based organizations all the way across this country, to churches, to community organizations, our tax dollars, talking about economic empowerment. And my question is, how the hell are you going to talk about economic empowerment in the Black community without, one, talking, including Dr. Claude Anderson, and talking to the Nation of Islam?
Why? Because nobody Black wants to have, nobody Black, no Black
exactly
politician really on any
exactly
side of the ideological spectrum wants to have anything to do with Muslims right now, because they are persona non grata. And I mean, that's the MO amongst our people anyway, because we never really stick together. The strength of white conservatives is they will not, I don't even know how they're going to have a Republican primary, because everybody's going to be on stage giving each other kisses on the side of the cheek. They don't attack each other under any circumstances. That was like Ronald Reagan's first commandment, that thou shall not attack another Republican. I don't care what you catch Sarah Palin doing. You catch her running out of a 7-Eleven with a gun in the hand and a bag of money in the other hand, all they're going to say is the jury hadn't spoken yet. It doesn't
exactly
matter what you catch them doing. They stand by their people
exactly
to the bitter end. I watched what happened with Charlie Rangel over some taxes off some apartment or whatever he had in some, I forget which country it was, Costa Rica, wherever
it
was.
And they threw him under the bus.
Under the bus, before the trial, before anything. You look at how people stood behind Scooter Libby. How they stood behind, who's the other guy, the Hammer? Forget the cat's name or whatever.
Cunningham.
Tom DeLay. They're still standing behind Tom DeLay, even after the conviction. What are they saying now? Appellate court hasn't spoken. You hadn't had the appeal yet. Hadn't had the appeal yet. They will stand behind their people to the bitter end. We don't do that.
It is our mindset, and until we change our mindset, we are going to continue to suffer disliberation.
And
yeah,
I
made up a word.
And we continue to ask them.
D-I-S-L-I-B-E-R-A-T-I-O-N.
We continue to ask them for permission to be us. Was that Akbar that says that? We continue to ask permission.
And look at Dr. Naeem Akbar at his age. I've known Dr. Akbar since he was Luther Weems, when he was in high school. Dr. Akbar has to work every day. He has to speak two or three times a week to keep his think tank going. 410, I've enjoyed your comments. We have a lot of material that we want to get to, and one of the material is to get to both Dr. Carnell West and Dr. Claude Anderson. Thank you so much for your call. And for those of you out there, don't forget that Our Common Ground broadcasts each Saturday night right here at Blog Talk Radio, 10 to midnight. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, two things that we are going to get you through. One is to understand the basics of how capitalism has failed in this country. The other is to understand why white supremacy matters in the labor movement, and to talk about the issue of how we change our mindset. Is that okay? I almost called you Akbar. Alpha, you stay tuned. We'll be right back.
And recognize their commonality of interest. But the whiteness and the lure of whiteness has tricked these have nothing in their bank account white people into believing that they got more in common with the rich white folks on St. Charles Avenue that didn't lose anything in that flooding than they have in common with the black working class folks who live about 500 yards away.
Smiling faces sometimes.
You know, Alpha, I figured it out. It's what you've been saying all along.
Finally, our premium level! The Congress! For this, you had to live in luxury, write laws that benefit your wealthiest contributors, and steal everything you can find till you're indicted.
You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Grant, Alpha of the Alpha Show.
My life was going downhill fast. Everybody was on my case. Now, I kept hoping that life would change real soon. I knew drinking too much messed up my life. A friend suggested I check out AA. It worked. I found myself in an AA group. Finally, I've got my act together. Alcoholics Anonymous. It works. Look us up. Check your phone book, newspaper, or AA.org.
Green technology, high-speed rail, and so on that the country badly needs. It's not a law of nature that we have to import solar technology from China, a poor developing country, or that we have to get high-speed rail facilities from Spain. Those aren't laws of nature. Those are political decisions. socioeconomic and political decisions, they can be made differently. If they're made differently enough, we'll be moving towards a kind of a anarchist type society.
Thank you for being with us at Our Common Ground, and to you out there, thank you for being with us here. We thank Dr. D for her call and 410, all making really great. I do think that we have some of the most insightful, informed listeners on the Internet, and I really do appreciate that, Alpha, and I think that you would agree. One of the things we do want to do in the time that we have left, and we only have about 44 minutes, is to give you a sense of the depth of how we need to change our minds, because as the issues of collective bargaining, the issues of labor rights, the issues of the personal economy comes down on our community, we're going to have to dig ourselves out. There is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. We can't keep thinking the same way that we think. Alpha, we've got to get people off the diet of thinking that they can have opinions without information. Huh?
Well, that's absolutely right. You know, Janice, I want to ask you a question. I know you know, I think you've known everybody this side of the Pecos. So do you know Dr. Claude Anderson?
Dr. Claude Anderson was during the 80s a weekly guest host at Our Common Ground.
Okay.
And I got to know him well. I worked with him with the Campaign for a New Tomorrow. I will always be grateful to my good friend Bob Law, who introduced me to him. And I've been to a couple of his workshops. And about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, he invited me to a meeting in New York, and I was kind of pressed about whether I was going to be able to be there, and so it's been a while since we have talked, but I do think that he has a lot of insight, a lot of resources. And the thing is that I love about him that I love his, he genuinely loves black people. He genuinely has transformed his brilliance into the spirit of empowering black people. And Our Common Ground is alternative activist empowerment radio, and we certainly will get him to Our Common Ground. Let's listen to what he and Dr. Cornel West have to say. They put an umbrella over all of these issues about the consequences of what's happening in America.
Who never said their name?
Back to history and memory. But no, but I think the reason why the question is problematic, though, Brother Matt, is one, that we're all wrestling with how do we characterize this new historical era.
Right.
And what is problematic for me about your question is why is it that when we use categories, journalists are famous for this, of post-racial and colorblind and now end of black politics, black people have to do all the disappearing acts. No black people, no black politics, but black suffering still in place. Well, something's going on. I would think the more appropriate question is, this is the end of the Southern strategy, which appealed to white fears and anxieties by scapegoating black people with busing, affirmative action,
welfare.
Crime, welfare, a whole slew of issues that Reagan to Bush have been masterful at deploying, and therefore, what does the end of the Southern strategy look like with the emergence of Obama as a candidate who still feels as if he got to stay on the tightrope? He can't be too identified with black people, characterizing part of what you were saying. We understand that. But if we don't understand that the best of black history is, in fact, the Frederick Douglasses and the Martin Kings, not because black people have a monopoly on truth and justice, but because we have our movement has expanded democratic possibilities. So in that regard, the Southern strategy and its end
right.
is a much more fascinating way of characterizing the era than saying, black politics disappearing. Disappearing? White supremacy disappearing? No. Taking a new form? Yes. Are we beating it back with Obama? Absolutely.
Right.
Let's celebrate that progress. But you see what I'm saying?
I do, but in fairness, Dr. West, I should
point out.
So
you agree with me today?
Well, I agree with you in part.
I like that.
I usually agree with you.
Yeah.
But the thing I'm telling you in conclusion is everything you do, play it to win. Practice group economics, group politics, build alternative economic structures, redesign your school systems. Right now, people are saying school systems are failing blacks. The school systems are not failing blacks. The school systems are doing exactly what they were originally designed to do. That was to produce you, to produce blacks who are marginally educated to work for whites. But now, as I told you, is that blacks are obsolete. They don't need your kids anymore. They don't need half-educated kids anymore. And so what you should do is go back and close down the assembly line and get your plan and say, we will now rebuild our schools across black America based on the needs of black Americans. In other words, what I'm saying to you is this. If I told you all right now we were going to the moon and we agreed to go to the moon, now our schools will know what to do. Because now they say if black folk going to the moon, you see, you got some direction. And now the school system say, well, now we got to produce more mechanics and more astronauts and more physicists and biochemicals. We got to prepare for that. But right now, the school system is still operating the way they were designed in 1867, with the produced black folk who were marginally educated people. And nobody wants our kids. Our kids keep telling you all that. That's why right now in the large cities, 65% of all the black kids that start nursery school never graduate from high school. They're telling you something, you're not listening. They're saying you're dysfunctional. There's no reason going to school. The school doesn't mean anything. There are no businesses in my community. There's no health. There's nothing in my neighborhood worth staying into. Go back and develop a national plan about where your people want to go, and then transmit that plan to every black individual, every black corporation, every black association. And then we can do it. We got the expertise. We got the skills. We got a little bit of money. And the last thing I do is get rid of a lot of our black leadership. Okay? All these black leaders in America now, the head of our two or three major institutions, keep talking about looking out for everybody but black folks. You tell them that day is over. Nobody's going to sell black folk anymore. The day of selling black folk over. If you want to sell them, you better find yourself another job. Because right now, black folk are hurting too much, and it's too bad for us in this world to keep letting black folk get up there and get in these high positions and talk about everybody but black folk. If you don't want to be black, go home and sit down and look at TV. And I tell all my friends, even those who look up the rainbow, talking about a rainbow coalition, as I'm telling you, there is no blackness in the rainbow. And if you want a rainbow, look inside my race and you'll find it. Look at this beautiful rainbow of people, all the colors you want. There's my rainbow.
While laughing at the moon.
takes my mind beyond the trees there, Alpho.
Well, Dr. Claude Anderson, you know, this brother is, you know, he's always spot on. He's always spot on with his message. His message should resonate throughout our community. But his voice
is... one of the things that I've noticed is that when he does get time, I mean, he's never going to get time on Roland Martin's show because it's not going to happen. When he goes on radio where there are loads of people, which the radio show is not on Our Common Ground, it's on commercial Make the Profit radio, the interviews don't give him a chance to speak to the people because the interviewers get in the way.
Absolutely.
So if you have a, you know, like I get real concerned because there is a young generation of talk radio listeners, but they want to hear nonsense. I mean, they get nonsense, so they don't know any better. You get what I'm saying?
Well,
now one of the things I wanted to do,
we've got to find a way. We have to find a way.
Yeah, we do have to find a way. We do have to find a way. Alpha, you're chopping up.
Well, I think it could be. I'm down to one bar on this phone. Maybe that could be it.
Okay. But one of the things I did want to get to, and I think it's very important, is the issue of how capitalism has failed in this country, because it all fits into what's coming at us. And I think it's so important for us to be able to think through, which is why I'm trying to get through all this material, to think through what this all means.
So is there an alternative to this, of course? For example, the alternative that was taken for granted by 19th century workers before it was sort of beaten out of people's heads by massive propaganda. Then you go back to the early Industrial Revolution, which was right around here, eastern Massachusetts. It was the period probably the freest press ever in the United States. There were lots and lots of newspapers representing different ethnic groups, class, you know, workers, all sorts of people. And there was a lot of participation, direct participation, very lively press, widely read, and so on. And if you look at the working class press, they were expressing the common view of working people, namely that those who work in the mills should own them and run them. Yeah, that's very natural. And as I say, we've come close to that a number of times, terrifying to private owners. They also held that wage labor is basically no different from chattel slavery, except that it's temporary. And that was such a popular idea that it was a position of the Republican Party. Abraham Lincoln espoused it. And it makes sense. I mean, there's nothing holy about wage labor. You are renting yourself, which is not very different from being a slave, except that maybe it'll end sometime. Okay, so those are alternatives. Self-management, democratic control of institutions, whether they're communities or workplaces or any others, alliances among them, you know, federal arrangements. These are all perfectly feasible alternatives. There's no economic or political theory that tells us there's anything wrong with them. They conflict with the structure of...
They say we must fight to keep our freedom. The Lord knows there got to be a better way. You tell them.
And you see, Alpha, one of the things that I think we miss is putting all of these contemporary problems and issues in a historical context. Here is a people who, as a result of fear of a black president, fear that black people and brown people are taking over their country, fear that black people and brown people are going to somehow descend to their positioning, that they would destroy their own interests. And that is my criticism of what Ed Schultz and Keith Olbermann and Sink now, they're missing that point, that there was a successful labor movement created not with but on the backs of black people, and why that occurred, because their formula does not include a calculation of white supremacy. My good friend Tim Weiss, and you know, I like to take the credit for forming this man. I met him at a Race Relations Institute at Fisk University many, many years ago when he was a student. He was an undergraduate student at Tulane, and he came to the first Race Relations Institute at Fisk because he was interested in the issue of race as a white man, of race in this country, interested in the sense of way deep down, as a young person, he felt the injustice. And I will defend Tim Wise because I have seen him grow. I have seen his passion and his commitment for his message about white supremacy and white privilege and how it works with whites. And yes, he's made a lot of money out of that, and I don't know if we can blame him for that, because that is the way white supremacy works globally. But he put together the historical sequence of how we got to this place in terms of the working poor and poor people in the context of labor and personal economics, and I do want to get to that. Is okay, that okay?
Okay.
In fact, in the old countries of Europe, we had spent most of our time killing each other. We didn't love each other. We weren't one big happy family. The side of my family that comes from Scotland, hell, they didn't even worry about fighting people outside of Scotland. Highlanders and Lowlanders just fought the hell out of each other. So there was no white race, but in the colonies of what would become the United States, what did we see in the 1660s, 1670s? We began to see that Africans of indentured servant status, many of them not enslaved yet, they were not necessarily permanently enslaved, some were, others were indentured like many poor Europeans for periods of 7 to 11 years. They could work off their indenture and then they would be free labor technically. Realized, as did the white indentured servants, the Europeans who hadn't even been called white yet, that they had a lot of things in common, like the fact that they were all getting their clock cleaned by the elite. And so they would get together, more than our history books taught us, to foment rebellion against the elite, to try to get a better deal for themselves on the basis of economic necessity and economic justice. And what did the elite do? When you see that you're outnumbered by black and white folks who are penniless, landless, peasants, you have to do one of two things. You either have to kill them all, but you can't do that because who's going to work? Rich folks weren't going to. They had to get poor people to work. The whole point was to be a person of leisure back in those days. That was the goal, was not to work. So you couldn't kill them all. You didn't want to kill them all. You had to do the work yourself. You had to build your own levee, build your own house. No. Pick your own tobacco, harvest your own cotton. No, we're not going to do any of that. So you can't kill them, but you can co-opt them. And so the elite in Virginia, for example, in the colony, begins to give certain carrots to people of European descent, saying things like, you know, we're going to let you own a little land, not much, but just a little. And we're going to get rid of indentured servitude. Now you're free labor. And by the way, once you're free labor, you get 50 acres of land. just because you're free labor, see? So we're going to cut you in on this deal. We're going to let you enter into contracts. We're going to let you testify in court. And here's the best of all. We're going to put you on the slave patrol to keep those people in line, right? The idea was you're still going to get your clock clean. We still don't like you. We still aren't going to really empower you or change your economic subordination, but we're going to make you honorary members of this team, and you're going to help us keep those other people down. And so they got a little taste of power, and it did effectively divide and conquer those coalitions. Those rebellions began to stop almost instantly. Fast forward to the Civil War era, you have rich white folks in the South, where I come from, standing up and openly admitting that the reason they're prepared to secede from the Union, and the only reason they ever articulated publicly, ever, was to maintain and extend slavery and white supremacy not only where it already existed, but into the newly acquired, that is to say, stolen territories from Mexico to the West. That was what they said. Now we lie about it. We say it wasn't about slavery, that it was about states' rights. Yes, the right of the states to keep and maintain slaves, exactly. But back then they had no shame, so they didn't try and cover it up. They openly said it, but once again, the rich didn't want to go do the work. Are you kidding? No. They're going to get poor people to go fight for them. And the poor folks didn't even own slaves. Now think, how do you get poor people who don't even own the shirt on their back, let alone slaves, to go fight to keep your slaves for you? You've got to convince them that their skin is more important than their economic interest. Because think about it. If I am a farmer who has to charge you $1 a day or $2 a week to work on your farm, and harvest that tobacco or pick that cotton, but you can get a black person to do it for free because you own them, who's going to get the job? Not me. In other words, slavery actually undermined the wages and the wage base, the economic floor of the typical white working class or low-income person. But they were told, if these people are freed, they're going to take your job. No, fool, they got your job. That's the point. And so at some level, again, working class white people being harmed by white privilege, relatively being advantaged, right? Being given a leg up, being given a membership to the club, but in absolute terms being kept economically subordinated by the very thing that gave them a sense of superiority. How's that for irony? Then in the present era, this hasn't stopped. This is not ancient history. Now we have people running around insisting that we should close the border with Mexico because if we don't, the wages of working class people will continue to fall, the implication being that the only reason workers are paid like crap in this country is because the border is opened. But if you believe that, you would actually have to believe that if that border were closed, that all these owners of capital and industry would just say, oh, well, you figured us out. Here, it's a raise. Do we really believe that the only thing keeping bosses from paying people more is the presence of low-wage, medium, semi-skilled labor from south of this artificial border? Is that really what we believe? We know that if that border is closed, it isn't going to be closed to capital. It isn't going to be closed to goods. If you have a border that can be crossed by capital looking for the highest return on investment or goods looking for the highest price, but labor is chained to its country of origin, how is that going to work to the benefit of working people? By definition, it doesn't. By definition, it immiserates the working class. Divide and conquer. But the best example of all, perhaps, in the contemporary era, in the greater New Orleans area after Katrina, here you have two communities that were the most hard hit. The Lower Ninth Ward, mostly black community, 94% African American, about 40% official poverty rate, heavy working class community. And right across the canal, St. Bernard Parish, Chalmette, 95% white, also working class, high levels of poverty, economically very similar. And at the end of the day, in those first few days of September 2005, more similar than they probably would have realized. Because when those levees broke, they all got their stuff jacked. They all got their stuff destroyed. But if you had asked white folks in Chalmette, and I've done it, who was the cause of the problems in the greater New Orleans area prior to that flooding, they would have pointed across that canal at those black folks, wouldn't have called them black folks, and would have said, there, that's the problem. 70% of the white folks in St. Bernard Parish voted for David Duke, white supremacist, neo-Nazi, former head of the largest Ku Klux Klan group in the United States when he ran for governor in 1991. 7 out of 10 gladly voted for him because he was blaming black folks for all of their problems, and they bought it. What's the irony? The irony is that while they were blaming black people for their problems, while they were blaming black people for the conditions of the greater New Orleans area in which they lived,
Nobody was paying attention, least of all they, to the fact that these white elite politicians, either in Baton Rouge or in Washington, whose job it was to secure those levies, to make sure that levy funds were spent in the proper way and that they were spent at all, those mostly white and mostly elite politicians did nothing. At the end of the day, it wasn't just the black folks in the lower ninth ward they didn't care about. They really couldn't have given a rat's ass about those poor and working class white folks either. And yet, when the people of Chalmette, people of St. Bernard Parish got back into session, first time they had a city council meeting, parish council meeting after the flooding, the lights aren't even on yet. The water isn't even hooked up. And the first order of business was to pass an ordinance saying that you couldn't rent property in St. Bernard Parish to anyone who wasn't a blood relative. Now, I'll leave it to your imagination as to why you'd want to pass a law. That law had never existed before. But now that it's been emptied out and you don't know who might come back, that's a damn good way to keep black people out, isn't it? Because if you're 95% white to begin with, if you pass an ordinance that says that, that's a great way. You can't say no blacks need apply. You can't say no blacks allowed. But that was an ingenious way to get around the law. Now, they got caught. There was a lawsuit threatened and they got rid of the ordinance. But my point in bringing it up is to say, once again, divide and conquer is working. These white folks in Chalmette need to march across that canal and join hands with the black folks who've been sitting there more than willing to work with them for an awful long time and march on Baton Rouge and march on D.C. and march on the Corps of Engineers and recognize their commonality of interest. But the whiteness and the lure of whiteness has tricked these have nothing in their bank account white people into believing that they got more in common with the rich white folks on St. Charles Avenue that didn't lose anything in that flooding than they have in common with the black working class folks who live about 500 yards away.
You see, Alpha, that's how you end up with thousands of people marching on Madison against a governor that they voted for.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, Tim Wise's work has always brought it to the bone. He's always brought it to the bone, and it's you can't get your head around why that message isn't more of a positive, you know, in our culture. Black people criticize him and call him a racist and the whole nine yards. You know, I don't know what all of that's about. But at some point in time, you know,
it's about how the propaganda around greed has permeated. It's about us embracing every damn thing that is Eurocentric. Because I'll tell you what it's about, and you know, I'm not here to defend Tim Wise or anyone who speaks the truth, because we are at war, and the first casualty of war is truth. And you know, and I'm standing here with my body in front to defend the truth, and the truth is that while we were working on trying to get the corporate jobs, while we were working on trying to make more money than the other black person down the street, while we were trying to emulate them, we weren't taking care of business. And the business was to train up a child in the way that they should go. We were too busy building mega churches. We were too busy building up mega American dreams. And now we have no one, Damu Smith, couldn't get the kind of support to do on issues of economic and environmental justice that Tim Wise got to do anti-white supremacy work. Ron Daniels had to stop doing what he was doing in our community because he had to get a job because he couldn't support his family.
And that goes back to what we were talking about of how the fighters of civil rights, the giants of civil rights.
That's right. The giants of the Black Liberation Movement.
Exactly. Of how
exactly.
We've been thrown under the bus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know who brought the suit that Tim Wise is talking about in that piece? The Louisiana Justice Institute, the executive director is a young woman by the name of Tracy Washington. You know who's doing all of the background work to help our community understand our interest in what's happening in Libya, our interest about what's happening in labor, our interest in what's happening on the African continent, our overseers on the issue of anti-apartheid issues all over the continent of Africa, young Black women who somehow had their heads screwed on straight. I'm talking about Makani Thembah Nixon, and I'm talking about Tracy Washington, I'm talking about Amira Harris, I'm talking about the Joshua generation. And they're so few because they all want to have a piece of the American dream, and the American dream is a doggone illusion. See, Alpha, you always get me going at the end of the show because there is a bottom line here, Alpha, folks. There is a bottom line. And the bottom line is that we need to get real about what the truth is. And we've got to stop depending on people like Tim Wise and George Carlin and Bill Maher and Rachel Maddow. And we've got to call out people like Roland Martin and Michael Basden and Warren Ballantyne to deal with our issues in an authentic, truly sensational way. Listen to what Colin told us the truth, and nobody in our community is requiring our comedians. They're still talking about drugs and snatch, but this is what was on the mind of George Colin before he died. I don't know what's going on here, but George Colin is not coming up. Maybe I've got too many of these things open or something. But I had this terrific piece by George Colin where he tells us we have no government. Is that good enough for you? We have no government.
And I've heard that
piece. It's an illusion.
And he's absolutely right. And, you know, the truths that are out there are the silent truths. And I say they're the silent truths because no one hears them often enough for them to resonate with everyday people. And just like you see these labor movements in Wisconsin, and you see that there is a genuine grassroots issue, you know, more people in Wisconsin and in all of these states have been protesting 10 times as many people have shown up that they did at a Tea Party, and they've gotten less than 5% of the publicity that the Tea Party got. I don't care what the Tea Party did, there were always cameras there to cover them, to lie about the gathering, to lie about their message, to make sure they had a platform to tell that lie. And that's what the mainstream media has done to win the perception of the minds of the ignorant. the vapidly stupid. So what we have to come up with is a new way to garner attention, to get the attention. Say something. Hit somebody in the damn head with a bat. But you have to get that attention. You have to step up and do something out of the ordinary. And I guess that's what makes for the far left. Because if that's what it's going to take to be far left, I'm right there. I am far left if that's the case. But up against the sound machine that we are up against, maybe that's what it's going to take.
Maybe so. Or maybe it's going to take that we get buried.
Well, let me put it like this. Like I said, this governor in Michigan, I don't hear the drumbeat should be recalled. That's all there. Don't give me a drumbeat of he's going to change his mind, he's going to veto this legislation. You know, when the outcry came out against Scott Walker in Wisconsin, you saw governors beginning to back down and beginning to say something else, all the way up until the reinforcements of Crossroads and Karl Rove showed up in Wisconsin. And then that gave them, emboldened them even more. Recall, nothing short of recall, should be on the table for Republicans in Wisconsin, the governor in Michigan, and I don't know the constitutional statute for recalling in Ohio and in Tennessee and in South Carolina and in Florida. You know, this criminal, Rick Scott in Florida, he only won by just above, less than a percentage point. So that's saying there is a great number of people who are against him, especially now with some of those, the majority, a lot of those that voted for him are now having buyer's remorse. We've got to find
This buyer's remorse bull crap bothers me. And that's why I went looking for trying to look at where this is all coming from. And we had said, Alpha, from the very beginning, the week that Barack Obama was elected president, we knew that this was coming. We should have been prepared, and we were not. We thought that he would save us. Now he is not. And where are we? Where are we? We're back. We have retrogressed to a place where the saving grace is what? What is the saving grace? We only have a short period of time, but I'm hoping that maybe Saturday night when we broadcast at 10 p.m. on Our Common Ground, somebody can call me and tell me what the saving grace is.
Oh, let's not turn blue, okay? Let's not hold our breath.
And even though we are talking about labor, we can apply most of what has been said here tonight, and we do appreciate our calls from 410 and our call from Dr. Deborah. I know she's tired. She's not been feeling well. And she did two shows tonight. So, you know, we have to learn that for us, this has many dimensions that are not applied to other communities. if we don't learn that unless we take control, nobody's going to give it to us. Unless we organize, mothers, parents, community people, and come to one accord about the importance of education in our community, about the impact of employment discrimination, the impact of housing discrimination. I mean, I was looking at some statistics that told me that people who actually file complaints of violations of the Fair Housing Act, 83% are people who are disabled, and they came into the act 10 years after it was enacted. Because there are people outside of our community who believe in their rights. And my question is, when are we going to believe the brother? When are we going to believe in our rights? The brother is absolutely right when he says that the empire is built in the law. I look at the generation of my law class. We were the last generation. We were the last generation of FIA to believe in justice and liberty. The rest of them coming behind us, the shit I had to take in both law school and business school, I paid for. Sometimes I say to my grandchildren, look at my back and look at the stripes on my back and tell me you're not going to do your best at school. Tell me you're not going to make it matter. I used to say that to my daughter all the time. Do I have to take my shirt off so you can see my stripes so that you can see what you must do? So we've got to work it from the local, from the personal to the local to the community and then to the national. And we've got to speak truth to power to the people out in Wisconsin and say, uh-huh. See what you did. You've been listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Graham. My co-host is Alpho of The Alpho Show. Please join us on Friday night at TruthWorks Network with India Declare After Dark. And you can join India Declare each morning, 11 a.m. Monday through Friday, as she brings you her real, raw, and right now. On Saturday, my co-host, Alpho, The Alpho Show at 3 p.m. Eastern Time here at Blog Talk Radio on TruthWorks Network. At TruthWorks Network, we know what to do with radio. Thank you so much for being here with us tonight, and we hope that you will join us on Friday night. We'll see you then. Thank you so very much.
Bitumen, get 'em in. That sun is hot and plenty bright. Let's get out of business and get home tonight. Bitumen. Auctioning slaves is a real high art. Bring that young gal, Roy. She's good for a start. Bitumen, get 'em in. Now here's a real goodbye on about 15. Her great-grandmammy was a die-homie queen. Just look at her face, she sure ain't homely. Like Sheba in the Bible, she's black but comely. Bid 'em in. Gonna start her at 3. Can I hear 3? Step up, gents, take a good look, see. Cause I know you'll want her once you see her. She's young and ripe, make a darn good breeder. Bid 'em in. She's good in the field, she can sew and cook. Strip her down, Roy, let the gentleman look. She's full up front and ample behind. Examine her teeth if you got a mind. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Here's a bit of 3 from a man who's thrifty. 3.